Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 280, I have the pleasure and privilege of being joined by my friend and colleague, Dr. Alexandra Rajitskaya. She and I discuss her career development, developing a career as an early retina specialist in academia, her involvement with the Argus II retinal prosthesis, getting involved in national organizations, and end with the discussion of the upcoming Vit Buccal Society Reproductive Health Seminar on February 17th. A link to subscribe and register for that seminar are in the episode description. In the episode description, you'll also find a list of relevant financial disclosures, as well as links to go to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website to claim CME credits for this podcast and many other podcast episodes. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be back with a new guest joining us from Cleveland, Ohio, Dr. Alexandra Rajitskaya. Dr. Rajitskaya is involved in several organizations, including the American Society of Retina Specialists, the Vit Buccal Society. She's also a retinal surgeon, educator at Cleveland Clinic. But most importantly, she's my former chief. So this is going to be a great opportunity for me to ask her those deep questions I never could ask her before. So Alexandra, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm surprised you couldn't ask those questions before. Let's hear what they are.
So to give context, right? So when you're a resident, you have a chief every year. So to say you're my chief feels weird because there's six different chiefs, right? Technically, but really as a resident, the people who are really your chiefs are your chiefs when you are just starting as a resident. So that would have been Anita and Tom Shane for me. For you, that I have to do the head in my head. It's probably, is that Amy and Brandon?
Correct.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. So, and I did the math in my head, but really the people who are your chiefs are your chiefs who are your chiefs when you're a third year resident, because you operate with them. And they're also the people who teach you in your first year. So they basically walk you from diapers to being a full-fledged adult and driving a car as an ophthalmologist. So you have seen me and my classmates at our worst. So maybe that's why I didn't want to ask some of these questions. And I put this off actually for a little bit because I didn't necessarily want to show too much favoritism, bring you on early. And I have so many burning questions to ask you, but let's rewind. So the first question we ask all our new guests, right? So, and I actually am curious about this for you because I don't know the answer. So why did you decide to become an ophthalmologist, right? So like, I know some of your educational history. I know you went to John Carroll. I know you went to Case after that in Ohio. But give us some of your backstory. Did you go to college knowing you wanted to be a doctor? At what point did you say, okay, I want to focus on eyes?
You know, Jay, it's a question that comes up often when you talk to some trainees. And I didn't grow up wanting to be a doctor. You know, I wanted to work in an ice cream factory because I wanted to eat ice cream. And then I wanted to work in a circus on be a trapeze dancer. So probably a good thing I didn't do those professions because we wouldn't be talking today. And I didn't, in medical school, I didn't know actually about ophthalmology. Sometimes it is a kind of a secret because if you're not exposed and you don't know about it a priori for some reason, it's hard to find it. I wanted to do cardiology and then actually got exposed. There's a retina specialist in Chicago, Zach Ravage. I did ophthalmology rotation and he gave me a book on ophthalmology and I was hooked and the rest is history. But it's just amazing how the life takes you, right? I feel like all of us could have done so many different fields. And when people come to me and ask, what should I do within ophthalmology?
Right.
I think once again, I can imagine myself being happy doing other parts, being a cornea specialist, but it's who your mentors are, people you meet along the way who inspire you. And that's how you choose your path.
It's funny you bring that up. I mean, I this is like match day was this last week. We're recording this a week after match day. So obviously you're talking to your fourth years who you mentored, but I've also had a lot of first and second and third year medical students come in and they are kind of trying to decide what they want to do. And I always thought it would be easy to kind of go back in time and be like, yeah, this is how I felt. But it actually gets harder and harder every year. I feel like it's the opposite for me, where it's harder to kind of remember and put myself back where I wasn't sure. And why did I choose this? And then for you talked about retina and other specialties, like I'm sure there was a point where I really, really could have done a lot of things, but now it's part of what happens is because you do the same things and you see the same people and you read the same papers and you're kind of thinking about the same sort of parts of the eye, it gets harder and harder to kind of imagine doing the other things, right? So like, it's interesting you bring up that perspective. I think you're wiser than I am, because I find myself kind of actively struggling the other way, saying, you know, I could have been a cornea specialist for blah, blah, blah reason, or glaucoma specialist for blah, blah, blah reason. So then you decide, you go to medical school, you apply for ophthalmology. Again, some people go into residency. I remember some of the applicants we saw this year, they know exactly what specialty they want to do when they're applying for residency. Now they have to write in their application, they're thinking about everything, but you can kind of tell from their letters and what they want. They have a very clear idea what they want to do. I was not like that. And we have that across specialties. We have people who want to do glaucoma, peds, plastics, retina. For you, you said you kind of referenced that there was a point where you could have done a lot of things. Even now you think you could have done a lot of things. When did you decide you want to do retina, and why did you choose to do retina?
You know, once you're absolutely right. Like when I started, I think as a medical student, you fall in love with whatever you're exposed. So I think I saw a couple corneal transplants maybe when I was a medical student. I thought that was a beautiful surgery. And I think the advice that was given to me and the advice I give to trainees when they ask me is twofold. A, think, you know, everything is exciting about complex cases, right? But think about the most boring stuff within each subspecialty, right? What would you rather see, dry eye or flashes and floaters? And there's your answer,
not
right?
Not even a question.
Not even a question. I mean, I couldn't do dry eyes, or, you know, like patients complaining about that one wrinkle or something. Once again, right? You have to think of that most boring stuff because that's what you have to deal with. You know, we can show our beautiful retina surgeries, but there's a ton of flashes and floaters that we see in clinic, you know, or whatever you think that might be, like non-compliant diabetics, but you know, at least that leads to TRDs. So, right. So, and then the other thing that I tell to trainees is look at the people. And see who you jive with, who are people that relate most to you, who you see being your future friends. Because the fields within ophthalmology, it's a beautiful thing, but it's so small, right? And I always enjoy telling, like, a patient comes in and they're like, you know, I'm going to Arizona for the summer, or for the winter, not for the summer. And I say, well, I know exactly who to recommend you, you know, while you're gone. And they're like, you know them? And I'm like, I know probably several doctors in each city in the United States and a lot of them personally. And so that's the advice I give to people. And I think that's what kind of guided me when I was deciding on subspecialty. And as you mentioned, those people, you know, the chiefs have inspired me, so many chiefs at Bascom Palmer, and also the other mentors that I've encountered along the way.
You know, I never thought about it until you said it. I do enjoy, in a weird way, seeing PVD patients and looking for tears.
Like it's not well, like, that's a little pathological, but
right,
it's
right.
Okay.
So wait, backpedal a little bit. I always am happy when I don't find the tears. I'm not saying it's the number one thing I'd want to see, but I don't mind it, right? And so I think that's part of it is, like, if you really hated doing that, then that's probably not a good field to pick. Just like if you really hated managing a patient with anterior segment dry eye, meibomian gland dysfunction, blepharitis, that's probably not the field for you or the patients you want to be seeing. So as you go, we're going to come back to a few things you said, but let's sprint ahead. So you go to Cleveland Clinic for your job, tremendous institution, rapidly developing department at the time you joined. I mean, it was already fully fledged at that point, but a lot of the people have been recruited in probably in the last 5 to 10 years before you joined, starting with the head of the department, Dan Martin. And then you have people like Peter Kaiser and Sunil Srivastava. I'm going to miss Amy Babuse, Justice Ehlers. I'm going to forget someone, Jonathan Sears. I'm forgetting a few too. You know your colleagues.
There's 13 of us in terms of retina, so it's a big group.
It's too big. I can't remember everyone. It was like a whole table at a big conference, or two tables. So you go there, and I think one of the biggest questions is you want to be an academic retina specialist is where do you start, right? So I think the first year is actually not that difficult. You kind of get somewhere, you get your bearings, you figure out the system, you're building your practice. You may still have projects from mentors and fellowship, but really that starts drying out, right? So one of the things you got involved with very early on was this Argus bioprosthesis. And we're going to get into that specifically, but like, what sort of advice do you have for people who get into that situation? Because I think there's a little bit of a limbo. Like the first few months, again, it's easy, it's exciting, it's new, you're building. And then you hit kind of a point and you're like, well, what do I want to do now? It's not anything that someone's telling me to do. I have to choose what I want to do now. Any advice or perspectives on how you decide that?
Yeah, I think it's a very loaded question, you know, and I think as it applies to you when you first start, it applies to you as you keep going. Mm-hmm. And I call it something like retina FOMO, you know, because you see people doing so many awesome things and you're trying to figure out, where do I belong? What is it that I'm doing? What is it that maybe, you know, we all want to bring something novel to our field, right? So I think of it also, if you step back and think about kind of the roles we play as retina specialists. So you mentioned clinical care, education, research, and leadership, right? Those are probably big buckets that we operate to one extent or another. So there's, you know, when I was starting, and I'm still, you know, I'm still kind of learning about this, I've found a couple pieces of advice very helpful. One piece of advice that I've found helpful is to find mentors. And when I was younger, I always thought mentor is this person that comes down from the skies and tells you, Alexandra, do this. Right. This is what's going to work, and this is the plan. But it's actually not true, because as I progress in my career, I'm becoming a mentor. And I realized that different people are good mentors at different things. And you have to figure that out. You know, and some people are excellent at many things, but one person might be good really to run like complex surgical things by, but might not be the best person to run like lifestyle stuff by or research things. So you kind of need to create that group of people who you can bounce things off. And I think that takes time, but it is very rewarding once you find that group. For instance, I have one person who I trust. You know, if this person tells me, you should pursue this opportunity of, I don't know, participating in this committee, I never question it, because that person has always directed me in the right way. And the other thing is, it's important to be a good mentee, which is also something I think nobody talks about, because now, you know, Jay, you can probably relate. You have a lot of medical students and residents come to you wanting to kind of establish that relationship. And it's, if the person is not prepared and they just want you to come and tell them what to do, it's also really, really challenging. And it's also, I think, very difficult sometimes to be a mentor, because you come from your own perspective. I'll give you a quick example. I had a student who was applying to ophthalmology, and very great student. Got awesome interviews, shows me his rank list. And I look at the rank list, and some of the top programs are like number 4 and 5. And I tell this person, I said, you realize by putting these programs at the spots, you're not gonna get in, you know, because you have to put them number 1 to get in. And I said, you know, to me it was shocking. And I said, what's your thinking behind it? And the person said, well, I think the program I have number 1 is where I'm gonna be happy. And it took me a second, because that's not my mentality. That's not how I think about things sometimes. And kind of meeting this person halfway and kind of understanding what their priorities are is really important, I think, as a mentor, to have that mentor-mentee relationship. The other point to go back to your question, because I feel like I digressed a little bit.
No, I like the digression. We're going to take it in that direction, actually, in a sec, but go ahead.
Okay, so the other point that I'm still struggling with, but I think is a very good advice, is going back to that retina FOMO thing, is what you're doing now is not necessarily what you're going to be doing even in 2 years, right? So I think it applies really for junior people. And I think it applies particularly for some women, you know, because if you, for instance, have a young family and you have to manage those things, or you have elderly parents, you know, and you're kind of trying to manage your career, but also responsibilities that you have outside of your work, stepping back and saying, okay, this is what I'm going to focus on now. This is what I can do now, and I can do that well. But, you know, things might change, and having that understanding and acceptance, I think, makes you a more satisfied person with your life. So to go back all the way to Argus, you know, it's not something that I quite envisioned. You know, I knew I wanted to do something, and I was enthusiastic. I was, you know, looking for opportunities, and it was like a perfect combination of things. You know, I was looking for something, and there was that opportunity. And then me and Alex Yoon, who is, you know, I couldn't have done it without him, really took it to the next level. But I think it's important to you know, to be open, you know, and not to also be set in a way, you know, some people come out and like you mentioned, you've done research maybe with your mentors from your training, and you're trying to really do the same thing and it doesn't work out, you know, be on the lookout for other opportunities and where those can take you.
So let's go back. I mean, that was a great answer. And actually, let's go back to what you were talking about in terms of mentoring. Let's talk about rank lists and applications and interviews, because I was going to ask you about this. I feel like the statute of limitations has passed to kind of talk about this since match day is over. And I've been kind of had people on the podcast who have interviewed or have been in that setting or have asked me my opinions on the podcast. And I've kind of deferred it because I think it's appropriate to wait until the process is over. But you are someone who reviewed applications and interviewed and also mentored some mentees this year. And your point about the rank list is fascinating, right? Because I felt like this happens every year, but I think it maybe happened more this year where some of my mentees show me the rank list. And I had the same reaction. I'm like, you know, I always think it's important to, I always tell my mentees, you do not have to change anything based on anything I say. And I think you referenced that too, but you just need to explain to me why you chose this order, right? Because my order may be very different than theirs for the same reasons you outlined, because you may have different priorities. We're biased by our experiences. We're biased by the places we trained for residency and fellowship. We're biased by the things that at that time we wanted out of our career or thought we wanted a career, and the things we think now are important to a career. There are many different aspects, and we're both people who are in academic retina positions, and there are a vast majority of people who are not that in ophthalmology, right? So we're a very small subset. But I think it's fascinating because I saw more of that quote unquote mismatch this year from my mentees rank list than other years. And I can't tell if it's a generational shift that's just slowly happening where I keep getting older and my mentees keep staying the same age. And they, you know, they used to be like, you're a few years older than me. Now it's like, you're a decade older than me.
I know. Right? You know, don't go there.
No, but you know what, but I always try to think like, maybe I'm the one who's missing the boat here, right? Like you referenced the happiness thing. People have talked about new doctors, new medical students. That's more and more of a priority is happiness and lifestyle. And of course the pandemic may have just accelerated that, but that might just be generational. This is a generation unlike you and I that grew up learning from computers, that grew up learning from their mobile devices, that grew up not getting textbooks and not taking notes in class and taking their laptop to class and surfing the internet while taking notes while, you know, on social media and multitasking all these things. Whereas you and I were like the kids with the thick glasses in the back of the room, like going to the library on the weekends and checking out books from places that are empty now, right? So my point is I still saw more of that mismatch this year compared to other years. And I wonder, we're going to talk about virtual interviews for a second, because you participated in fellowship and residency virtual interviews. I really cautioned them and said, you know, you never actually went to these places and you haven't set foot in these places. And I haven't been to all these places, but I've set foot in some of them. And I know people who worked at these places, and things do change from when I applied, which is 12 years ago, to now. But I was just like, I just wonder, you know, the way I'm going with this is there's going to be a question asked at the end of this process for fellowship and residency by the SF Match, two applicants, two programs. What do you think about virtual interviews once the pandemic is over, once we feel safe to travel, once we're all vaccinated? Do we go back or not? Because I will tell you the early returns just from talking anecdotally to applicants, the medical students, is they don't want to go back. They loved it. they think it's great. Now, it'd be interesting to ask them in 2 years when they match and they go to a place and they're like, I really love this or not. Is it true? But I think it's just an interesting question. We're obviously biased because we didn't do that. So maybe we think it's not a great idea. But do you see what I'm saying? Like, I wonder sometimes if it's just that we don't know exactly, you know, they don't know exactly what they're looking for.
You know, that's an interesting point. I actually haven't thought much about it. And I also haven't heard what you mentioned that the applicants liked it better. Because I think for all of us, it was like, okay, we're trying to make do with the situation that we have. And that's why we're doing these virtual interviews. And I think there is a big shift in general in medicine. You know, if you take a step back, you know, it's, and what I mean by that is that technology is becoming, you know, we are now, I mean, I remember when I was in training, we had paper charts, right? I still remember Nina Barakal's paper chart, and on the retinal exam, it would say, looks great. And that's all it said, right? And so, you know, looks great can be, it can be different for different people. You know, it could be attached retina, you know, 20/20 vision, or it could be like a horrible PVR case that, you know, there's a patch of the retina attached that also looks great. Mm-hmm. But I think it's actually, technology is going to become more and more dominant in what we do. We're talking about AI, you know, and it's going to come to retina for sure because we're so image driven.
Right.
And I actually think that is there's going to be a change. We are going to go back that there's going to be so much the computer can do that I, as a physician, might not have to look at OCT and try to find each spot of intraretinal and subretinal fluid. Right. An algorithm is going to tell me, you know, this patient's subretinal fluid has decreased by such percentage from last time, you know, intraretinal fluid is this. And so I think actually that patient interaction is going to become more important because that's what the computer can do. And to go back to your point, I think that human interaction and seeing a place is paramount, in my opinion, right? Because there's something about it that you can't convey on Zoom or you can't convey on a virtual platform. It's interesting though, because I was participating in another meeting and they did a, I don't know if you've tried this, this program is called Topia. Have you played with that? So the idea is you actually have a little avatar that moves.
Oh, I've heard of this.
And as you get closer to a group, you can start talking to people and like your face lights up. But as you walk away, you can't hear them anymore. So it's not like in Zoom where everybody can hear everybody else. And it was interesting to participate in something like that because I think one of the programs actually used it for their social part of the interview. But I'm surprised to hear that people liked it.
I mean, we have to see what the data shows. Yeah. Like, that's just anecdotal, but I will tell you, most of them were like, it was fantastic. I didn't have to spend money. I didn't have to travel. I could wake up in my own bed. I could do multiple interviews on the same day. I didn't have to worry about flying coast to coast. I could go and eat lunch in my own home and then come back. I didn't feel like I was under the microscope the whole time. And those are actually all valid points. I think that maybe you can argue that the virtual interview is more beneficial to the applicant than to the program. It's applicant centric, which is maybe what we want, is it protects them more. But I also think that, I don't know, I struggle with it because I think part of the process from our end is we do want to put people under the microscope for that day, not under bad way. It's not like we're examining them, but it's just because you're going to spend 3 years or 4 years with integrated programs with somebody. It's like choosing to marry someone, but never meeting them in person. Right. So it's like, and that has been done in my culture. So that's a separate discussion, but like, It's like this idea, and again, there may be a huge generational component to this where they don't see a problem with that because they're used to this. They're used to, you know, if they want to go on a date with someone, they can communicate virtually with that person for months before they meet them, and it's fine. That's just something that we didn't grow up with. But I'm really curious because I'll tell you on my end, I thought it was difficult. I thought doing a virtual interview is really, really hard. It's really hard to gather information that's actually useful while at the same time being comfortable and warm and friendly and nice enough, Because you have to remember, just like we're getting a limited snapshot of your applicant, what I learned talking to my mentees is they're getting a limited snapshot of the program, and every little thing when they're making the list adds up because they didn't get a whole day, right? They got 2 or 3 hours on Zoom, most of which was probably informational or just standard questions or listening to a resident talk about the program. They didn't get what you're talking about with the Topia app or real life, where they wandered into a conversation and heard something that really excited them or really turned them off. They didn't get any of that interaction. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, let's tie that into our next topic. So like virtual meetings, right? So you're involved in ASRS, you're involved in BitBuckle Society. And we'll talk about how you got involved in that, what people can do to want to get involved. But what do you think about virtual meetings? I've asked a lot of people on the podcast, it's all opinion-based. Like, where do you think we go from here, right? Because at the one hand, I'll be honest, I think it's very difficult for me personally to invest as much in a virtual meeting as it is an in-person meeting. In terms of, you don't get the social interaction, you don't get the things that, again, the human aspect of it. And part of you, and psychologically, is kind of like, well, I can just listen to all of this later or read about it later. Why do I need to block off my Saturday when I'm home with my family or if I'm a retina specialist with my kids to watch a meeting when I can just watch it later that night? It's on demand. I can do it whenever I want. It's kind of our culture now. We don't block off 8 p.m. on Sunday to watch the top show in the country. We just expect the whole season to drop on Netflix and then binge it when we want, right? So like, I feel like culturally, the meeting thing makes sense as we transition. People are gonna be like, I don't need to sit in a room to hear this. When you have all the information, I'll sit in my own time and watch it. But at the same time, I see the benefits of virtual meetings. They're more democratic. They reach more people. They allow people who may not have the time or the means or the energy or the money to fly all over to participate and give talks and be involved. What do you think about virtual meetings and where they go as we head hopefully towards a virus safe future?
I think it's a very interesting and point. And I think in general, right, meetings, interviews, patient care, right, everything is gonna be affected by the experience we had in the past year. And I think to your point, I think there is a role for virtual meetings. Mm-hmm. I think probably some kind of hybrid, depending on what the meetings are, is gonna be the future. I'm with you. I miss in-person meetings tremendously, right? I miss seeing people. And I think also for, you know, to go back to, you know, being a junior person and starting off, it's so important to be exposed to people in, you know, at a happy hour or at some kind of social event where you can just talk about whatever, which is, there's no way to reproduce it in virtual meetings. I think content-wise, virtual meetings are tremendous, right? As you mentioned, for instance, I'm doing like a virtual meeting. I think it's like next weekend at 6 o'clock in the morning. That's with India, right? It probably wouldn't have happened, you know, or maybe there would have been one in the year that I had to plan months ahead to go. Whereas now I can, you know, I was invited a couple of weeks ago and I'm going to be able to do it because it's from home. So I think virtual meetings are very good for content and on-demand content, as you mentioned. You know, you can watch it and moreover, you can speed it up. So you can watch 5 talks and instead, right. So there's benefit to that. But I think meetings are not only content, and I think there's so many other networking opportunities that I missed, and also collaborations, right? Like if you're presenting something, I guess I could chat you and then maybe follow up by email or whatever. But if it's in real life, I could come up to you and say, hey, you presented this awesome thing. I'm thinking this and this, and it's much more natural, I feel. But I think it's interesting in general. Have you had an experience where people send you an invite for a meeting and it's just a phone number and you're like, where is the video component? You know, I must be missing something.
I am not that popular, so that's not happened to me.
No, but it's so weird now because, I mean, we used to do everything by phone, right? A lot of right. things that we're doing Zoom for now or whatever other, you know, platform you use.
Right.
I remember there was something somebody sent me and there was just a phone number and I'm like, this is so wrong. I must be missing the link.
Right.
So I think it's really that virtual approach has really invaded kind of what we're doing. We actually put together a little write-up in through early career section at ASRS, talking about how do you behave on Zoom? You know, what are the do's and don'ts? You know, it's a totally new culture. And I think it's interesting because, like you mentioned, a lot of these events happen after hours and happen in the evenings where you might be doing it from home and all the kind of complications that come with that as well.
So there's like three interesting points there that we could talk about. I don't want to get too far off topic because I want to wrap up with a couple other things. But I think the first thing is that I wonder about is investment, right? And this goes back to medical students interviewing or anyone. Are you as invested in an interview at a program or in an applicant or in a meeting where you're presenting or watching if you don't go through the steps to go to that? I'm not talking about the financial investment. I'm talking about the time and energy investment. And so like, I always wonder this is like, programs probably had to interview more applicants because it's easier for them to just take the interview even if they're not interested. And applicants probably have to interview at more programs because programs are easier for them to say, hey, we'll invite 65, we'll invite 70, 80, you know, as long as they have the time to do it, it's not physically bringing people in. And I wonder, again, if you don't invest the time and energy, do you get as much out of it? Now, that sounds really like old man, get out of my lawn. Like, I don't understand this generation because there's different ways to garner that investment. Maybe I just need to get better understanding of that. But it's hard. But the second part is attention. Like, I remember in medical school, our lectures were recorded. You know, this is mid to late 2000s. And I would watch a lot of those lectures on 2 or 2.5 times speed. Did I get as much out of those lectures as if I had been there? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe some of them were bad and I wouldn't have gotten anything out of it. Maybe some of them were good and I would have learned things that would have been useful. I can definitely tell you it didn't make me more likely to pay attention if it was 2x speed. It just meant that if I zoned out for a minute, I missed 2x as much information while I was not paying attention. So like that, and maybe again, this is my bias and maybe people are better than I, but I just wonder, we have a culture and technology and everything that enhance ADD. Less investment, you can do more things. And going back to the TV show analogy, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s, people used to sit and block off a time to watch that show, right? I'm gonna sit and watch the finale to Lost or whatever. I didn't watch Lost, but friends watched it. But now it's like Netflix, okay, I binged the season, okay, move on. I move on to the next one. You know, you don't have that same investment. Tomorrow's the Super Bowl. It's still one of the few things in America and in the world that people block off that time to have a party, a safe party, hopefully, but a party or watch it or whatever. If it was on demand and you could watch it anytime without knowing the result, would it have the same impact? Would as many people watch it? Maybe, maybe not. Is that important? I don't know. And then the third thing you referenced was, you know, you were talking about, I just blanked on the third thing, the sign of getting old. But the third thing was like, we talked about investment. We talked about the energy that like you put in attention. And then the final thing is like, what does it mean for involving people? Are we getting the right people involved or not, right? That's always a loaded question, but it's, does this setup hurt certain people while it helps others? So it helps people who may be willing to have a voice. They're extroverted, they have thoughts, they wanna participate, but they physically can't get to a meeting. Or they couldn't have afforded to go to that residency or fellowship interview. And does it hurt people who they may speak up if it's a two or a happy hour at a residency interview? There's a group of two at dinner or three at dinner. They may speak up in that instance. But if it's a 6-person room on Zoom, they're just quiet. They're just not going to speak up of other people. That's not their personality. That's not where they thrive, but they still may be a fantastic resident. And does this hurt in meeting terms? Do you now select against people who, like you said, the spillover into the rest of your life? The work, after work balance was always a little off in retina, especially academic retina or academic medicine, because you had to travel and things. But now is it spilling over into your dinner time with your family, into the time you would have spent with your kids and the time you would have spent with a significant other? Because there are no boundaries, because everyone's like, hey, we're not asking you to fly here. We just want you to give a talk at 8 p.m. on Thursday night. And that may be when you do your homework with your kids or when you put them to bed. And so are you selecting against some of those people now, or are you changing culturally that kind of division of this is my work life and this is my personal life? I don't know if we have the answers to that, but I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, and we can kind of go into the last topic about organizations.
Yeah, I think it's kind of has two sides. At the same time, you know, where you're mentioning it might affect your evenings or your, you know, Saturday mornings. But also I found just that it allows people more opportunity to participate. Mm-hmm. You know, people who I'm not even talking about the applicants, but, you know, people, young females, right? If you have a little kid at home, the chances of you traveling somewhere for a meeting or for an ad board are not as high because you have to arrange all this childcare and everything. And now you can, you know, you can have them in the room next door and you're able to participate. So I think there's benefits as well. You know, it's all depends how you look at it. And I think that's why I think we're probably going to keep it to some degree, because right. It does fill that void that we had before. But maybe, you know, I don't think it's going to replace in-person meetings. And I really hope it doesn't replace in-person interviews for fellowship right. and residency.
So a couple last questions. What's your favorite ice cream flavor? Working at ice cream factory.
So coffee. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Not as a kid though.
Not as a kid. What was your favorite flavor?
I wasn't that advanced. I was like vanilla kid.
Vanilla. Okay. That's those are solid answers. If you had said something weird, like Rocky Road or I don't know. It's hopefully someone out there I'm not offending, but, so other question, you know, so you are somebody, like we talked about, you're involved in organizations, you're involved in education. I'll tell you, like, not to put you on the spot or be embarrassing, but you were like, you were my consult resident when I was a first year resident. I think one of the things you did that I really valued, which no one really did besides you, I think you're the only person maybe in the history, maybe you learned it from someone in the history of the residency who did this, is we would round like every day on those patients. Like we would sit down and go through this and we would physically go and see so many of those patients besides rounding with an attending. You were like, I really took that responsibility to be like, I'm going to go and like really, really be hands-on with this and not just defer to an attending. So like your general kind of philosophy for how do people get involved? You talked about mentorship and menteeship, but like they want to get involved in ASRS. They want to get involved in BitBuckle. Why should they, right? So first question I always ask someone if they want to get involved is like, well, what's your reasoning for why you want to do this? But how do they go about it? And what are kind of the qualities that are helpful to people to being successful in those roles?
You know, it goes back to also an advice I got very early in training. And it's such a simple advice, but I think it's such an important one. And I was told that half of the battle is showing up. Right. You just have to show up, and otherwise people don't know that you're interested, right? So, and virtual, you know, going back to virtual, it makes it a little bit more difficult. But showing up and kind of showing enthusiasm is half of the battle. And the other thing is, I think it's important. I mean, it's important to know your limitations, and you don't want to say yes to everything, especially if you can't deliver quality product. But you know, being open to opportunities, and people sometimes feel like, okay, I want to do this within the society, but there's no way to do it right now. And they kind of like, oh, well, then I don't want to do it. Well, right. Then maybe you should do something different. And, you know, and that might open different doors, and eventually you might end up doing what you really wanted to do. So I think, and going to a more micro level, you know, I work with a lot of people, and I think what makes somebody makes somebody good is such simple things as like answering your email on time and right. and you know being responsive, and it's simple things that we all do day to day, but that makes everything move. So I think that's important, and also as to go back to the comment I made about being a good mentee is letting people know, you know, if you're interested in something, I can't read anybody's mind and nobody can read my mind. And I found that if I tell people what my interests are, and they might not have some opportunity right now, but you know, something comes up and they're like, oh, I remember like a couple of years ago, Alexandra mentioned that she was interested. Well, maybe I should reach out to her and see if she still is interested in doing something like that. So I think that's the advice that I was given, and that's the advice I give to my trainees right now.
Couple of plugs. You referenced, you know, some of the difficulties women may have and the advantages of virtual meetings. Well, we've got a virtual meeting coming up very soon. We're going to be releasing this a few days in advance, or people may not be aware. You want to tell us a little bit about this BitBuckle event that we're hosting on February, I think, 17th?
Yeah, so it's February 17th. It's a Wednesday, 7 o'clock Eastern time. And this is actually kind of unprecedented. I've got a lot of feedback. It hasn't happened yet, and I already got a lot of feedback. So it stemmed from the idea, you know, we talk about physician wellness, and it's such an important topic. And I was thinking about, sometimes I'm a little bit, I feel like more concrete and algorithmical, and I was trying to see what really problems that I've encountered. And this comes from personal experience, but also I had an experience where I was talking to one of my my residents, and literally we were in line for Starbucks, and this person turned to me and she said, "Do you think I should freeze my eggs?" And I was, you know, I didn't know what to say. I didn't have an answer. And I felt it was such an important topic for young females, you know, in training and as junior attendings, and also for their significant others. So this is how the idea of this wellness webinar came to me. It's a wellness webinar that's going to focus on reproductive choices. And what the way it's structured is I wanted it to be very facts-driven, and I wanted it to be things I wish I knew when I was younger kind of approach. So for instance, what we're going to have is we're going to have reproductive endocrinology and fertility specialist. So somebody who knows the all of it, you know, and all the data on it. And then we have people who are retina specialists from across the country who volunteered to participate, and I think all of them. And we're going to talk about things like freezing eggs, in vitro fertilization, egg donors, surrogacy, and the people who actually went through these processes talking about what was surprising to them, how could they have been better prepared, you know, what is it that they wish they knew when they were younger. And so I'm really excited. And like I mentioned, I've gotten already people, we have more registrants than I expected. So, sure. But if people are interested, please join us. This is not actually limited to, you know, there's no limitation. You don't have to be a member of VBS to participate. And the information for the webinar is on the website, and the website is vidbucklesociety.org.
Perfect. And then, you know, we'll put a link to register also in the episode description. So again, we're going to release this a couple of days before. Fantastic, unique, groundbreaking kind of webinar. I know people use that word a lot, but this is truly a groundbreaking webinar for our field. And also, I think in medicine, I just can't remember many events in any field of medicine, you know, outside of maybe OBGYN talking more about counseling patients or in the MFM community. So this is wonderful. And I think that we'll see, it'll be a great learning experience for all of us. So Alexandra, thanks so much for joining us. You were very generous with your time. And again, we were going to plug the Fellows Foray too, but we can come back and do that as we get closer to the event, since I know we closed off record-breaking submissions. You want me to just say a quick note about the Fellows Foray? You can thump your chest a little bit. Oh, most ever, right?
Well, yeah, it's actually not done me at all. We have a tremendous team through the VBS and our partners at Evolve, Camilla, Anton, Will Park, and Susan and Ellen at Evolve have done a tremendous job. We do have a record number of submissions. So this is what I'll be doing after we're done with this podcast, to start reviewing those submissions. Right. But it's 80 plus. So please log in when we have the winners presented, and we'll talk about it later, I think, and announce that later. But also for all the trainees, if you're going to be in fellowship still next year, consider submitting.
Start your video cameras now. Record everything. So, Alexandra, thanks so much for joining us, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks so much, Jay. This was great. Thanks so much.
As always, you can find this podcast and many other podcast episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's retinapodcast.com. All 280 episodes are there, sorted by category and archived for your listening pleasure. We also are on your Android and Apple mobile device in the Android and Apple Podcasts app. Please keep in mind, you can always reach us by contacting us directly on our website by clicking on the Contact Us link, or by reaching us via our email, retinapodcast@gmail.com. We're also on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast. We love to hear from you, hear the things we can do better, the things we're already doing well, and what you look forward to in future episodes. Many thanks to Dr. Rajatskaya for joining me for this episode. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai and Dr. Angela Chang, along with Dr. Mike Vinacosta for producing this episode and the accompanying social media. Many thanks, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, the conversations you inspire here, and the patient care you deliver on a daily basis. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.